Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Zachary Hirsch, assistant professor in classics at the University of Colorado, Boulder. This is episode CCXLV, False Nero. When Nero took his own life in 68 CE, it was the end of an era for Rome. The Julio-Claudians had ruled for close to 100 years, and with the end of the dynasty, there was confusion, civil war, and an outpouring of grief. Some would exploit this confusion and claim to be the still-alive Emperor Nero, with the intention of retaking his empire. Here's Zachary Hirsch.
One of the reasons why I love The False Nero is that it illustrates a way that people engaged with Roman political culture that was clearly a big part of Roman life that is just very, very hard to find in the fancy historians who generally get to tell our story of how Rome worked. Mm. The False Nero is different and confusing and a little dirty and a little tacky in ways that I suspect are very familiar to us and kind of makes history make more sense.
Okay, so if we could pull it back to the start then and set the scene for us, tell me about Nero and the death of Nero and the circumstances that came together at that time at the end of the Julio-Claudians.
Of course. Conventionally, when we talk about the Roman Empire, we divide it into dynasties. It's not necessarily the case that everyone in the dynasty is going to be related. There's literally an adoptive dynasty. But generally, dynasties are periods that are interrupted by brief civil war. The Julio-Claudians is the first dynastic period of the Roman Empire. It starts with Augustus. Sort of when you think Roman emperor good, he's usually who you're going to think of, right? He's cultured. He's a patron of the arts. He oversees sort of a great moral revival. You could tell how seriously I take all of this. But sort of most importantly for our purposes, he reigns for a very long time and dies in bed. There is another way to think about Roman emperors, the trashy movie one, and that's really where you go with Nero. Nero is the last of the Julio-Claudian emperors. When he dies, there's no successor. And he is a mess. According to our stories about Nero, he is put in through a plot via his sort of scheming mother, who also might have been his girlfriend, but who he definitely murdered. There are a lot of kind of different angles here. Nero is also a patron of the arts, but in a different way. He famously will lock people in a room so he can give poetry recitals to the point where people were faking their death in order to escape. He toured Greece, competing in Olympic Games, where he kept on mysteriously winning. Mm. And, you know, obviously he's killing senators left and right. He's stealing money. He's accepting bribes. He's corrupt. He's sexually decadent, yada, yada, yada. He might or might not have set the city of Rome on fire and then played a lyre while it burned. That's a story a lot of people know. He also apparently blamed the Christians for it, although, again, our sourcing for this is horrible. What matters is that eventually the senators get sick of Nero and start a pretty substantial conspiracy to take him out. I mean, I think at this point, if you watch the news, you know a little bit about how coups work. Mm. Sort of doesn't work until it does. And then everything falls apart very quickly for our Nero, who flees Rome and ends up killing himself. His last words are recorded in Suetonius as, "What a great artist I perish as." It's less awkward in Latin, but only a little. And just sort of that level of ego. And then everything goes away. That's the true Nero.
Mm. It's a Nero that I think Rome as a city, as an empire, moves on from quite quickly. You very quickly have a civil war and a winner all within a year or so. And everything goes back to relative acceptability of normal. It doesn't seem like there's a big Nero hangover or that there's a big outpouring of grief, at least not in the historical sources that we get. But the fact that there are false Neros makes me think that the people of the Roman Empire might feel a bit differently.
That's, I think, exactly right. It may be worth taking a second to explain what we mean by false Nero. Mm. So in the years after Nero's death, roughly 5 to 10 is really when this is most common, you see a number of provincial revolts, sort of popular uprisings in the eastern margins of the empire, led by people who claim to be the long-lost emperor. And these can get pretty big and pretty hairy. They're far enough from the imperial center that we're not totally sure what's going on, and our sources don't describe them in detail. But provincial affairs are disrupted for a long time in some of these cases, trying to deal with these revolts by people who are trying to restore, I'm doing air quotes, but this is a podcast, I don't know why I'm doing that, to quote unquote restore Nero to the throne. And these are popular revolts. This isn't like scheming elites trying to bring back the corrupt ruler. People loved the guy. And you can see little hints of that elsewhere. So Antonius, I believe, mentions flowers being laid at his grave for years, even though sort of the Senate wants him dead. Mm. And these revolts are sort of the provincial version of that. In Rome, people are laying flowers. In the Greek East, people are trying to overthrow the government. But this indicates to me two things. One is that people actually living through Roman imperial history as it was happening were as confused about what was going on at any given time as your average undergraduate. And two, that people didn't all agree on who the good and bad emperors were.
Mm.
The Senate is happy to be rid of Nero, but the Senate's not everybody.
There are three major instances that I found of false Neros. And if we could talk about them in a bit of detail, but just firstly, why do you think that it was the eastern provinces, the eastern part of the Roman Empire, that these false Neros seem to crop up? Is it because Nero identified a lot with that area and those cultures and went there and won the Olympic Games that puts him more fresh and relevant in the mind of that area?
So I think there are kind of two explanations that dovetail. So the first revolt is just all over the Greek islands, and it kind of starts there and sweeps Asia Minor, right? That one, I think, is absolutely a story about Hellenism, about Greek identity. Nero famously was obsessed with Greece. You know, he's playing the lyre as Rome burns. He's going through Greece doing these mock Olympic games. And while the Roman Senate finds that embarrassing and cringy because it is un-Roman, and our historians tend to come from the Roman Senate, and those interests are overrepresented. Mm. People actually living in Greece seem to have found this flattering, charming, meaningful, sort of an acknowledgement of their perceived cultural superiority. And so they might have been anxious to return to a period in which Greece was more unquestionably the cultural center of the empire. That's the first of the three revolts. There's another side to the story, which is that the second and third are on the far, far eastern edge of the empire. And Rome, you know, that eastern empire, that eastern border is not a coast. Rome shares a sort of shifty, contested, unhappy border with a Central Asian state called the Parthian Empire. And relations between the two are always confusing. Obviously, there are times when it's out and out war. A lot of times it's better understood as sort of chilly and hostile. And I get the distinct impression reading these stories, you have these false Neros showing up who are then fleeing and taking refuge in Parthia or leading their followers into the Parthian Empire. There may be some intrigue to this as well, that there have been various periods of time when these Greek-speaking communities in Western Asia were more or less looking west to Rome for political leadership or looking east to Persia and Iran. And Parthia may be encouraging these kinds of rumors, or at least supporting the imposters themselves in order to destabilize, in order to collaborate. So I think there is a cultural component and a geopolitical component, and it's very hard to separate out the two, given that our evidence is, can't emphasize this enough, bad.
But we do have, especially for a couple of the Nero's accounts, can you take me through the story a bit? Especially, I find the first one very interesting because it happened so quickly It happened during the reign of Vitellius, which was all of 3 months, the year after Nero committed suicide. Yet it seemed to take hold very quickly and be a problem that needed to be dealt with.
Yeah. So what happens with the first one is, I'm just thinking of Tacitus right now, you're dealing with a freedman from somewhere. So a sort of lower status person who's not well known, who starts claiming to be Nero and developing this enormous base of popular support pretty rapidly. The thing that I find really fascinating about this is that eventually, when this guy is killed, the general who had taken out the false Nero literally does a little tour of Asia Minor with his head, just showing it to all of these different subject communities before the head finally goes back to Rome. So he can, you know, prove to the emperor that he got the guy and, you know, get his money, right? Mm. And there's obviously, again, I think we have to understand this as reflecting the people yearn for Nero. And that's very obvious here. But also, the people have no idea who the heck is emperor. Matt, have you ever tried to teach people what happened after Nero was assassinated? I have. It's not pretty. So after Nero is killed, you have the short-reigned emperor Galba, who's in for about 3 months and is recorded as sort of stern, a little mean to his soldiers, but basically decent. He's, you know, trying to restore the republic and all that. Soldiers aren't having it. And eventually everyone revolts in favor of Otho, who is more fun, but also more decadent and corrupt. Otho is himself attacked by the third of these sort of minor emperors, Vitellius. The only good thing Otho does is kill himself. When he realizes that he's screwed, he decides to just deal with this neatly so that sort of everyone can move on. Once he is dead, everyone can just get together behind Vitellius and civil war will end. Of course, that doesn't work because the sort of general with the biggest army who's been doing all of this properly is coming in fresh from putting, as he's been putting down a revolt in Judea, Vespasian marches in on the city of Rome. Vitellius also eventually dies and Vespasian just sort of takes over the city. It's very quick, but it's very confusing.
Mm.
And it is easy to imagine how someone living in this environment who, remember, doesn't have newspapers, who is hearing about things only as fast as like a horse can go, you know? Information is traveling very, very slowly, and this is a moment when political conditions are changing very, very quickly. It's not like any of these are peaceful successions where you're going to get to keep up the statues of the old guy, right? You can sort of imagine, okay, I'm erecting a statue to Galba. Oops, okay, gotta take that down. Okay, now Otho's the guy. No, but seriously? Another one? You can see why this would be enormously confusing and upsetting for people. In that environment, where you've never met any of these people personally, you've seen statues of the emperor, but that is it. You've maybe seen paintings, but there's no reason to think they were very good paintings. If some random dude is like, hey, they told you I was dead, but I'm not, I'm Nero, why aren't you going to believe him?
Mm.
You know, that's not an easy call, especially if you kind of want it to be true. And I think the sort of, see this guy, here is his head. That's important because these are audiences who have probably never seen the emperor in person outside of these sort of Neronian tours, which people went crazy for. You can see how excited people were to see the emperor in person. And there's sort of a reverse of this at the end of the first Neronian imposter, where the head goes on a triumphal tour of the Greek world so people can see for themselves that we're done with Nero. We are moving on from Nero.
But that, as a practice, to actually take his head and parade it triumphally like that could backfire when the most that people are going to be familiar with Nero is by seeing his head on coins and seeing a bust of him in a forum or something like that, and then you're seeing his head and being told it's a false one, I guess, but you've got to kind of take Rome at its word for that, that that's the case.
The whole situation is just incredibly surreal, isn't it?
Mm.
That sort of Elvis has come back from the dead and, you know, sort of this rock star politician, and your entire province has gone crazy for him. And then all of a sudden, Rome's like, nope, this is not real. Nope, bye-bye. And now all of a sudden you have to come in and look at this random dude's head. It's a very jarring, surreal experience. And we might think about this. Maybe what you're seeing here is less, come study this head, compare it to the coin in your pocket in order to sort of compare their like noses.
Yeah.
Maybe what you're actually seeing is the people with the knives are telling you officially that Nero is dead. Whether or not it is true, everyone agrees that this is the story. And see what happens when someone screws with the story? You can see his head right there.
Mm.
You don't want to get your head cut off.
Yeah.
If the state is showing you this, there's a threat there. And I think people would have understood that.
So the next case that we've got of a fake Nero, this comes from Cassius Dio, actually.
Yeah, this is Cassius Dio. Yeah. Terentius Maximus.
Terentius Maximus, which sounds like a good gladiator name.
It really does. And I wonder, it's a slightly odd name for like a fancy man.
Mm.
And that makes me think we might be looking at another sort of socially mobile freed type. The thing he's best known for, though, is he's a singer. And he gets his initial support through musical performance.
Mm.
That he's able to do this thing that everyone understands as Neronian. And again, remember, Nero's voice isn't recorded. People know Nero sings, but presumably someone who was putting a reasonable amount of effort into imitating Nero while he was alive could probably pull that off well enough when people don't quite know what's going on. But really, the thing about Terentius Maximus is that he is the one who goes over to the Parthian Empire. This is under Vespasian's son, Titus. And the Parthians absolutely love the idea of destabilizing this nascent Flavian dynasty and are, you know, threatening to restore him, would like to intervene in this Roman quote-unquote succession dispute. These are maneuvers that are very, very common in how Rome intervenes in other places' affairs. So I think there's kind of a mean joke in reversal to this. That said, he eventually gets found out and killed pretty quickly. That might be the Parthians killing him. That might be the Parthians giving him up to Rome. We really can't easily reconstruct the diplomacy here, except that it goes very poorly for our poor Terentius.
Mm. I can see why it happened at that time as well, I think. The third example that we've got of a false Nero being 20 years later, the timing of that so far away from when Nero killed himself, Nero would have been a much older man if he was still alive. That's a strange case. I think this is the best documented false Nero that we have and could have gone very badly for Rome.
Yeah. So what we've got here is, once again, he's clearly well-liked. But the reason why this is so dangerous is that this guy in particular really comes in with the Parthians. It's actually not super clear this is different from the second one coming in under Titus, but the Parthians are really willing to use these false Neros, and with the third one sort of gets the closest, as an excuse to go to war. It's not necessarily that this guy is so scary because he's going to unite the Roman people anymore. That's not what's happening with a third or fourth false Nero. It's that the Parthians are scary and everyone is worried about what is going to happen. This actually comes from Suetonius, an imperial biographer, and it's vague and strange. Some person of obscure birth gave himself out for Nero. That name secured for him so favorable a reception from the Parthians that he was very zealously supported, presumably by the Parthians, and was only with difficulty returned to Rome after that. This is, I think, a good hint as to why these kinds of situations are so dangerous. When a state can't sort of manage its knowledge, when a state can't make sure everyone is clear on who's dead, who the emperor is, what's going on, bad actors can use that misinformation to sort of weaken the state, create internal difficulty, and try to sort of gain diplomatic upper hands.
Mm.
Now, this isn't a period that's well recorded in Roman history. You know, it's just our sources for the Flavian Empire tend to be a lot later than the Flavian Empire. But it also is pretty clear the second and third false Nero turn into diplomatic disputes. Our sources are never going to be great when it comes to diplomatic negotiation. That's always something that emperors are going to misrepresent, that is going to be sort of laconically recorded in official media, and is going to involve a lot of under the table dealing. Mm. It seems very obvious that sort of there was a lot of delicate discussion with the Parthians about what to do with this guy who was sort of a destabilizing force, but they won. Rome negotiated with the Parthians and the false Neros went away.
It's interesting that the first false Nero that we discussed came from the people and had more populist support. And these other ones, which were much later than the first one had the immediacy of Nero just dying and the confusion of that situation of the civil war. But these ones tacked put into how they can be useful.
It rewards cynicism, doesn't it? The first false Nero seems to reflect genuine excitement for a different kind of leadership. I also think Nero is a bad guy, but like, there's clearly a lot of genuine support for this person in the Greek world. And then the second and third seem to be largely foreign policy problems, pretending to be a dead guy.
Mm.
They are sort of representing some kind of foreign meddling, perhaps foreign encouragement of conspiracy theories in order to destabilize domestic government. But, you know, that would never happen.
So what is it about this trend then that you think it happened around Nero? I mean, part of me thinks that this is idealizing the Julio-Claudians and trying to resurrect something that's had a line drawn under it, because it is such a big change to lose that dynasty for Rome.
Oh, yeah.
But then seems to be a genuine desire to believe amongst some. And I think it also says something about when this happens in other examples in history, where we've got the sole survivor of different regimes who is suddenly, you know, revealed to be in hiding in another country. This isn't the only example of this happening. I also don't think that it's something that can happen easily in the modern age when you've got YouTube and photographic evidence and we're much more familiar with how these people would look.
Well, first of all, one of the things that's always sort of tough about a figure like Nero is that we can't really reconstruct what people who liked Nero liked about him. Our historical tradition is so dominated by a group that Nero clearly had no interest in and did not base his politics around, that it's hard for us to figure out what people saw in him. They clearly saw something. And I also think you're right, there is a Julio-Claudian nostalgia that if you want to understand the empire as sort of supra-institutional strongmen, Nero doesn't really have Augustan blood, but we can sort of pretend in a way that we can't with Vespasian, in a way that we can't with the more institutional emperor is a job kind of system that is emerging over the course of the Flavian period. So I think that's part of it. And I also think just at moments of major political shift, I immediately think of Anastasia Romanov. There are a million different examples of this. And, you know, often people do kind of go into hiding. This is a thing. People like the mystique of, you know, pseudonyms and hidden people and hiding among us and no one knows who's who. You know, QAnon functions very similarly, right? These sort of conspiracies in the background and hidden transmissions and people you think are dead are not actually dead. Didn't they all think that JFK Jr. was secretly alive? He hadn't been assassinated, then he was going to sort of come and run the government. Mm. This is a very, very common feature of conspiratorial thinking. Even today, we form strong attachments to political and celebrity figures. You know, people saw Elvis after his death for decades. It can be hard to imagine that these people you love but have never seen, you might not believe that they're dead, and you might want to picture them sort of fulfilling new roles in your life. People get very, very strong feelings about emperors and political figures and celebrities, and sometimes those feelings make us see things that aren't there.
That was Zachary Herz, Assistant Professor in Classics at the University of Colorado, Boulder, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome.
If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any readily available podcatching platform. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Blue Sky. Zach is at Zachary Hurst, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast was recorded and produced at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.